Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
My name is Grant Sanderson. I run a YouTube channel about math. My background is one of studying math and computer science in college. I spent some time at Khan Academy thereafter, also in the online education sphere, and essentially since then have been doing things related to online math lessons in various forms, predominantly video.
Yeah, you've had an amazing, successful career, and I know a lot of the students have followed it and studied a bit about your background. Do you mind if we jump straight into some student questions?
Let's jump in.
All right, cool. One of the kids from France, they want to know what inspired you to start creating educational videos, particularly focusing on math and computer science. Where did that come from?
Well, I'll answer the two parts. The videos fact probably came from the fact that there were a couple channels on YouTube that I respected and followed. Minute Physics comes to mind as a particular inspiration, or maybe Number File, kind of showing that there's an appetite for math. But part of it was just that I had this itch to do more math, to make some visuals, to use that as a form of sharing it. I enjoyed teaching in casual contexts like tutoring or giving little kinds of talks. And it just seemed like a natural side project to take some of that, but then put it on this online form, especially given the precedent set by some of those very, you know, early generation educational YouTube channels.
Well, you're definitely one of the trailblazers with that. Now, we studied a lot about your background. You went to Stanford University, and one of the kids, they wanted to know how your experience at Stanford shaped your approach to teaching and creating content. Was there some type of influence there?
I would say the CS department there has uncannily good education. So I love the math department and would spend time there. That's what I majored in. But it was, and there were a handful of great educators there, but predominantly people's main focus is research. This is what you'll find in most university departments. The CS department stood out where there were a couple, not just a couple, but many, many key individuals who were really excellent educators. So Keith Schwartz, Mehran Sahami, Jerry Kane, there's like many that I could list. And a lot of that centers on simply care that they put in. I think Keith Schwartz spent like 80 hours a week on his slides or something like that. It was just truly, truly a work of love there. But also seeing how effective project-based learning can be, or somehow the correct problem to work on is really where people learn the thing rather than a particularly well-articulated lecture. And it's hard for that to come through in YouTube. It's not a medium that lends itself to giving people projects or problems. But I think even if you just keep in the back of your mind that the way that learning happens is to try to bring out from someone a sense that they themselves are solving it, that can hopefully make the lecture experience a little bit better. So ironically, the most influential parts are the things that I have the least power to actually do over the medium.
It's almost like you're describing a sense of mastery, like where the student has a mastery.
Yeah, definitely. And more importantly, the fact that mastery can only come from a feeling of doing it yourself. And that a really good teacher is one who comes up with the kinds of problems that guide you into that effectively, and gives the support structures around that. So in the CS department, a given teacher, it wouldn't just be that they're the one that's running the show. They'd have a whole suite of, you know, TAs or section leaders who are helping people like in the lab with their projects and things like that. And the substance of it really came from choosing the right projects and then making sure that there was AI is seeping into our lives.
You're okay.
And so that can influence what a good lecture looks like, because it means that the role of the lecture is to get someone to think about the right kind of thing that either in the moment they feel like they're discovering it alongside with you. They're not just like ingesting someone else's discovery. And then hopefully it's ones that inspire someone to go and think a little bit more with that particular topic, or give them a tool in their belt such that they feel confident in whatever other problem that they're solving to build that mastery that you're referencing, that they can only come from want something driven within the student and not something that's passively happening as they're listening to a teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a question from Princeton. He's in Spain, and Princeton sent this to me. He's got kind of a noisy background, but he wanted to know what kind of advice would you have for someone like him who's pursuing a software engineering degree?
Focus on the internships. With software seems like a domain where so much is learned on the ground in terms of working with a large team and a large body of software that's hard to replicate in a university setting. And so many people will describe where they learned real software engineering was on the job, whereas the thing learned in school is more like computer science or some of the foundations. I think like Git would be this example where people would reference they only learned how to use Git on a software engineering job, not in their computer science like degree. But I think there's a thousand little things that also come in where what does it feel like to work on a massive code base that no one person can wrap their head around? It's hard for that to be an assignment, but it's a very natural thing to come up in an internship. And so value those, be deliberate in one, making sure you're doing them, and then also choosing where you go and that you have good mentorship when you go there.
One of our kids from Spain has a question from you, and this is Manuela. I'll let her unmute. She had a really awesome question. Go ahead and ask, Manuela.
Hi. I actually have already watched your channel on YouTube, Three Blue and One Brown, and I was wondering, how do you choose which topics to explain and the channel?
I wish I had a systematic answer that was principled. It ends up being month by month what I feel most inspired to run into. I will say it used to be the case. I would focus a lot on just things that tickled my own interest, and then I would share that. As time's gone on, I've tried to place more value on the things that people actually have asked for. So if there's a lot of requests for parsing a particular technical topic where I also feel like adding visuals would add something to the space, then I'll run with it. If it's something that a lot of people request, but I can't think of a way where like the stuff that I do would be much different from all the other channels out there, I might let it go. But it'll come in two categories. Either it's exposition, it's a topic someone might think to search for, and then I just ask, do I have something to add there? Or it's some kind of problem-solving thing that just delighted me so much I couldn't help but share it. And I don't have a system of saying when do I do one or when do I do the other. It's very, month by month what catches me.
That's wonderful, and it's certainly catching a large audience too. One of our kids emailed from France, and they want to know, how did you get involved in the Netflix documentary about Infinity, and what was that experience like?
Was weird. Yeah. So the short answer is Stephen Strogatz was someone who they interviewed as part of that documentary. He and I had done a project or two in the past and just like chatted with each other. Like we have a connection and a just shared mutual respect. He mentioned me to them in the context of a scene that they were illustrating where they wanted, like Steve was describing how Infinity was like this monster and calculus was the tool that came into history to help people tame that monster. And in the movie, they wanted to have a like a cardboard box kind of rendering of Godzilla destroying a town, and like somehow there being a notion of calculus analysis being what is used to conquer that monster. And they had this quirky idea related to doing Fourier analysis of its roar. And it's something they were like, okay, we're not going to explain this. We're not going to like have the documentary explain what's going on. But if we had the right visuals, maybe people who are in the know could have a little wink nod moment. And it was a cute idea and one that I was like well suited to animate. And so through the Strogatz connection, they asked. And technically, like this is one of the funny things where like the whole documentary was beautifully illustrated in a very eclectic form, and it ended up winning an Emmy for graphics, which means very, very, very technically, I like was part of a group that got an Emmy and was like qualified to get one of the statues like sent. And I'm like, oh, this is a thing I wouldn't have thought would happen in life. But it was purely a function of having illustrated Fourier related things and then talking with Stephen Strogatz about something where that style of illustration happened to be what they were looking for.
Emmy-winning creator Grant Sanderson.
Extremely technically, there's so many asterisks around that.
Which brings me to my next point. This comes from me. This next question: how important to you is visual learning?
I would say, like, it's obviously important. This is the thing that I'm making, but less important than one would infer based on the stuff that I make, because everything I make is a super visualized explanation of something. And that's just because that's the niche that I want to fill. It's where I feel, hey, I can add something that someone else might not necessarily add in the world of YouTube lessons. But that's not to say that I think in order to learn something, you have to visualize everything that it is. The way to deeply understand math is to make sure there's always a visual with it. It should definitely be viewed as one of, two or three different strands braiding together to constitute understanding. Like algebraic manipulation It's kind of one of the greatest inventions in mankind, and like lets us do extremely powerful things and derive facts beyond the scope of what we can understand through other means. And that shouldn't be taken lightly. And also, there's a lot of very beautiful intuition that comes from just pure symbolic play that it's not what I naturally discuss on the channel. And so I might accidentally end up conveying the lesson that I wouldn't intend to, that like the best form of understanding is the visual form. It's just that that's where I feel well suited to do something different.
One of the kids here in the States, they wanted to know who are some of your favorite collaborators from other educational YouTube channels that you had the opportunity to work with.
I mean, I like contributed to a Mark Rober video, and Mark is one of the greatest people out there. I mean, he's someone who deserves every bit of success that he gets, and he's so genuine and so hardworking and just really, really smart. Henry Reich, who runs Minute Physics, which is what I referenced earlier, he's someone who really helped out early on in the channel's life in like behind the scenes ways for providing advice and mentorship. And he's someone who I would just do anything for. Steve Strogatz, I brought up, where he, if I need to like interview someone for something, it's just a guarantee that the interview will go well and he'll like add a really delightful narrative around something. He's someone you can just put a microphone to and you're going to get something completely delightful. Diana Cowan of Physics Girl, we had a very fun project that we did a while back. And I could list many others, but th those are some of the highlights that come to mind.
Diana has been a guest with us too. She's awesome.
She's great.
We have a question from Europe, and the student has an awesome question. Go ahead and unmute to ask.
Hi, so it's such a coincidence because I like TED Talks, and I just had happened to or had already watched your TED Talk before I even knew you were like a special guest here. So my question was, how did you choose what to talk about in your TED Talk?
This was a couple of years, if I remember right. Yeah, I think that one was centered around what makes people interested in math, and in particular the story component of it. I can't remember why I chose that. That was a kind of topic I would center on with certain talks around then, and trying to draw parallels between construction of a math lesson and storytelling principles. Partly because I think it's effective. It's something you don't want to do in a very on the nose way, where you have, there's these two characters and they're going through adventures in math land. But in a much more subtle way, if you recognize that what makes a story compelling is like development of relationships and the idea that like a character changes over time, and then mapping that onto ideas instead. Okay, it's not going to be people who are the characters, but it can be the case that there's a certain concept that's very underdeveloped. And you want to say, how do we develop this over time? And it comes from its relationship with other topics. And thinking of it in your mind like a story that you're telling, even when it's very explicitly just a math lesson and you're doing something technical, I think that can result in something that keeps people's attention for a little bit longer. I can't say why that was on my mind at that time, but that was a set of thoughts that I found valuable to think about.
That's great. recently, we had Stephen Wolfram on as a guest, and I noticed that you taught a course on computational thinking at MIT. Could you talk a little bit about computational thinking with the students?
Sure. That course was interesting because it was run by a group who essentially wanted to get more people using a particular programming language called Julia. And one of the things that they were motivated by was how, if you have something that's easy to understand but also performant, it unlocks a playfulness in how you interact with certain kinds of questions that might be performance bound. And I will say, when I'm making a video, the fact that I'm illustrating it programmatically is very helpful as a source of engaging more deeply with the topic, and sometimes even fact checking what I'm saying in the video, where I might have something I want to describe. I set up the simulation to illustrate what the thing looks like. By seeing how the simulation runs, I learn something new about what empirically happens that I didn't know before. And then that helps inform the lesson itself. And I think that cycle where you've got an idea, you actually implement it in some way, it forces your hand to recognize things that you don't understand. And then it also can expose patterns that are just not visible through the definition of a given setup, or even through what you can do by hand, but instead only become visible at certain scales or certain amounts of complexity that only computers are really well suited to display for you. And so anything that you can do, whereas you're engaging with the topic, you're coding it up in some way, almost always helps shape your understanding of it for the better.
Well, it's a few more questions and we'll let you go. I know you have very available time, but one of the kids, they wanted to know what was it like contributing to Quanta and how is writing for a publication different from content creation?
It was good. It was it was a topic that I wanted to get out in some form, but maybe just wasn't going to put the time in to produce a full video on it. So there's something appealing to the idea that once you've written the text for it, that's most of the value, and like the text being the output is quite nice. The big difference in working with a publication of some sort is that there's editorial oversight, and therefore, someone reining in especially a tendency to go too long or to bring in unrelated ideas. I think that can be a healthy relationship. It's not one that, like, from the creator side, sometimes it's a little frustrating in the moment where you say, oh, but I really want to talk about this. And then there's the editor that says, but you don't need to. And I think that's healthy to have. And so it's not something I do very often, but I have been thinking about, if I were to, write a book that kind of supplements some of the content on the channel, why that would be very healthy. Partly, there are certain topics where simply being able to write it without the concern over eventually producing it in a fully animated way, it might be very liberating. And then also working with someone else who can help rein in scope creep, it stands to be very healthy if you find the right person to work with. And Quanta has some great editors, so that was a good experience.
That's great. And you talk a little bit about quite a bit about visual learning. What role does animation play in your teaching methodology?
Honestly, a lot of it is just that it keeps someone with you, where if you view education as like inside a student's brain, you imagine, I don't know, a little cup filled with liquid, and that liquid tells you how much attention they have and how much you're asking from them to focus on something is like drilling a hole in the bottom of that cup, and things are seeping out, where the harder the topic is, the thicker that hole, so like more liquid is going out faster, and the more easy you make it for them, the smaller that hole. I feel like the visuals can help to reduce the flow rate out of that cup, where it's just if you make it a little easier to understand, if you make it such that you don't have to do quite as much cognitive processing to turn the symbols and the words that you're hearing into a more concrete instantiation of the idea, maybe you can actually work with like the amount of attention that they have in there without it completely draining out before you get to the main point. And maybe if things are sufficiently beautiful, that in and of itself is kind of a motivating thing that makes you want to keep with it, that pours a little more liquid into the top of it. But I don't know if it's necessary in the sense that there's no other way to understand these things except through visuals. It's just that it does a lot to lubricate the process to make it such that you can realistically work with the amount of attention and attention span that someone might have as they're sitting in front of you.
It's like you're appealing to different types of learning modalities. So, and as a fellow educator, I that's great. Can you touch? Because is it two more questions good enough? Is that good for
Works for
you?
me. Works for me.
So, what are some of the biggest misconceptions in your professional opinion that students have about mathematics? Like, where do they fall short, do you think, when it comes to the learning process?
Probably the biggest one is just the conception of what math even is as being some people will end up with the impression that it's about performing algorithms because this is what's tested in school. And so if you ask an elementary schooler, what do they think math is? It's going to center on like numbers and multiplying things. And the image of like, if you describe a professional mathematician, they'd be like, what do? Like multiply really big numbers all the time? And we can laugh at that. But I think some people will have a similar impression, like what does a mathematician do, even if they're in high school, where it's this feeling that, oh, you've got all these problems and you're just kind of crunching through harder and harder versions of these problems. And so certainly the biggest misconception would be the lack of awareness for what a creative art it can be and how sometimes the path to unlocking an ability to solve things that people couldn't before involves a lot of very lateral creative thinking, and it feels like invention more than it feels like cranking through something. That's a hard idea to convey without giving someone that experience, and I think there are ways to give them that experience in a more elementary context, but it's hard. It's very hard to come up with examples of doing real math that are accessible, and because it's hard, I think it results in this, kind of sad misconception for what the field even is.
Yeah, that's a very brilliant way of You simplified that answer. So there you go. So our final student question, or actually our final question, I asked this of all of our guests. Grant Sanderson, you are so accomplished in what you do. What kind of advice would you have for these kids as they go on to the next stage in their life, whether they want to do a career in math or engineering or whatever, or something completely different? What advice do you have for them?
Sure. I actually just gave a commencement address, so I was thinking about these kinds of questions. And the number one fact I wanted to have in there was highlighting how when you're a student, the implicit way that you're being evaluated is to learn and to grow. There might be, realistic things where seeking a degree or passing a test doesn't actually feel like learning and growing, but at least explicitly, this is what people are like stating about the goal of the education. It's that you personally learn and you personally grow. But in life afterward, success is determined by how well you're adding value to other people. And sometimes that shift, even if you acknowledge it at a conscious level, takes a while to deeply digest. Where my peers after graduation, if I would ask them about their job, how they like it, they would center so much on how much they feel like they're personally growing. They're like, oh, I like it, but I'm not really working on very interesting problems. Or I'd like to find something where I, really feel myself growing day in, day out. That's great. Like personal growth is great. And sometimes necessary for gaining an expertise that helps you add values to others. But you really want to be aware that like the actual ultimate goal is how can you be of service to the people around you, and the skills that you gain are a means to that end. Whereas right now you're at a point in your life when the end in and of itself is to learn. So that's fine, run with that while you have it, but just like be aware that that's a shift that will happen. And one of the ways this might manifest, let's say someone's really passionate about math. Or like physics or something. Like, great, I'm so passionate about math. I really want to do more math. And they go and they get a PhD in it. And at some point, they find that it's hard to get a job, or it's hard to like find satisfaction. And some of it might be because a little bit later on they realized simply pursuing that thing that was a passion that grew during the time of school no longer served the success function in life after school, which is, hey, how are you adding value to others? And okay, maybe you pursued math and you're a really good researcher and people find value in that research, or you're a really good educator and people find value in what you're teaching them. But recognize like the only way that it's working is insofar as you're helping others. Earlier on, there might have been other things that you could have thought about for how to bring math to bear in domains that don't often get a lot of mathematical talent. And I sometimes wish that a lot of the people who were passionate about the subject kept an open mind to pursuing other fields where they're bringing math into that other field, rather than necessarily just staying, single-minded focused on the thing in and of itself. So that's one broad thing, is being aware of that shift. And then sort of in the service of that, valuing personal projects, so things that are done maybe outside of school or maybe done like with a group of friends, so things where you have a sense of ownership over it, like get in the habit of having personal projects and following through with them, finding collaborators with them, because the muscles that you build in doing that end up being quite similar to the things that are necessary to finding ownership over a career after school, whether that's very entrepreneurial, where you're actually making your own thing, or even if it's in the context of another company, where rather than merely being someone who follows instructions, if you're creating new things within and taking ownership, that's what can make you stand out. So build that habit of personal projects now, and then it will be a natural source of momentum later, rather than a new thing that you have to introduce into your life.
That is absolutely brilliant, Grant. So we can't thank you enough for taking time out of your valuable day to talk to us. And before I end the meeting for all, I allow everyone to unmute. And can we all unmute right now and say a quick thank you to Grant Sanderson for taking time out of his valuable day to come talk to us? Thank you so much, Grant. We appreciate you greatly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.